Yeah, we began with the same picture of Netter. Startling simplicity. I mean, this is the key to all of Netter's mathematics, is the simplicity of it. When you look at this equation, what leaps out at you is that these three lines are all a derivative at x. X is here. This is the Lagrangian expression for any number of dependent variables, one independent variable, and this variation is just equal to this derivative. Well, when it's zero on solutions, the variation is equal to the derivative. And that's really most of the proof of the theorem, in fact. What struck me when I hadn't realized this when I started doing this, people before Netter didn't really write it quite like this. This is, on one hand, you could have shown this equation to Lagrange. Lagrange would have absolutely understood this equation. He would have seen how to derive it. He wouldn't have been surprised. But he didn't write it like this. Nobody before her wrote it in exactly this order. But there's nothing surprising here. And I also want to stress that this is classically understood and correctly understood to just depend on additivity of derivative, chain law, and integration by parts. We're not solving any equations here. We're just additivity, chain law, integration by parts. And we're getting this equation. And to her, she looks at this, Netter looks at this and says, right, it's just a derivative. It's the derivative of this long expression. If you need to know what's being conserved, you need to know that long expression. And I will have to agree with Peter Olver. It is characteristic of Netter to work in a lot of generality, but also to seek simplicity. And the reason she works this, she allows dependence on arbitrarily many derivatives. Oh yes, I mentioned arbitrarily many dependent variables, one independent variables. I should have said the Lagrangian depends on kappa many derivatives. That's a kappa, I didn't recognize it as a kappa at first, but it is. And it is in tech also. The reason she allows all that is the calculations led her there. When she tries to calculate backwards from a conservation law to a symmetry, it's got these derivatives in it. And she just absolutely trusts the calculation on that. I will also mention, yes, if you have multiple independent variables, you would have gotten a sum of those partial derivatives in place of the total derivative. It looks like a divergence itself, except that those things aren't functions. They're differential operators. Of course, they become functions in different contexts, but they are, in the first place, differential operators. So what I'm going to talk about is the place of this in Netter's career, how she develops this thinking about it. One thing you will see here, and it's true, I mean, I'm not only doing this, Netter always thought in formulas, absolutely always. She doesn't talk about symmetries, just nothing about symmetries. She talks about transforming variables, and that's because that's what she thinks about. Her ideas became crucial to geometrizing lots of parts of mathematics, in the hands of her own students who were talking with her daily, but not because she thought geometrically. It's not. She defines a divergence as a kind of expression, and that's not just a word. We'll see reasons why she could only define it as a kind of expression. She really means a thing you can write down, because she doesn't know what else it could be but a thing. She knows how to write it down. She, like Klein at least sometimes, in 1918, she puts conservation law in quotes four of the five times it occurs, and the fifth time it's just right after another one she'd already put it in quotes. I don't know if Klein regularly put it in quote marks, but her in 1918 essentially always puts conservation law in quote marks. Because she's just thinking of formulas. And this produces her originality, her generality, her simplicity. We'll see more of that as we go along. This is her in about 1930. We'll talk about that picture later. background on the mathematics, there's still a lot of background at different levels that you could go into. What I want to mention here is what struck me when I was looking into this. Euler and Lagrange knew roughly that when you do variational mechanics, symmetries correspond to conservation of something or other. This was clear from the start of doing this kind of physics. It was the whole idea of Hamilton's method of ignorable coordinates. When you read dynamics books from this time, calculus of variations books, they always explain Hamiltonian mechanics as a really great way to find out that some of the coordinates don't appear in some laws, and that means they're conserved. So this was an absolutely general understanding that there's something here about conservation and symmetry. She cites very complicated derivations of special relativity and Newtonian mechanics from symmetry considerations. This was a genre people were doing, especially people in Göttingen. She cites extremely specific ongoing work in general relativity. She sees these particulars. I will tell you, the derivations of special relativity and Newtonian mechanics seem to me a lot more complicated than they have to be, or would be now. But they exist. I mean, she knows that. She cites people doing this kind of thing. Her breakthrough, what's distinctive, her really distinctive contribution here, is the utter generality, and it's simply this. She tells us it's just a combination of the methods of the formal calculus of variations with those of Lie's group theory. That's what it is. Now, you just put the two together, you write them down on the same page, and you get Netter's theorem. If you're Netter, if you wrote them in the right order. You write them down, the result is on the page in front of you. Now, this vast generality means it has unforeseen applications, and Peter Olver especially has championed going off and seeing some of them, especially more advanced later ones. The generality, and this is the problem, the people who are trying to derive special relativity get special relativity. And then somebody says, ooh, you didn't just have to do that for SR, I can do it for Newtonian, which was harder to do because the symmetries of Newtonian mechanics are more complicated. But they get Newtonian mechanics. They get nothing unforeseen. Because they had a particular physical problem in mind, they solve that particular physical problem. They don't get other solutions. But this is not Netter's concern. I don't know any reference to particular interest on her part in physical theories. I'm pretty sure she was in Göttingen in July, and I would bet, as you think, if she was there, she'd go to this thing, and she was really good at learning stuff. But there's, her friends later don't talk about her talking about it at all. So I'm sure she was there, and we know she mastered it because it's late in the 1918 paper. But it's not what she's interested in. She's interested in the mathematics, and it's just that simple. I do want to return to that quote, a combination of the methods. Oh, this, I suspect, is the age she was in 1918, more or less. I'm not good at dating from photographs. Some people are. I keep meaning to get somebody to really do it systematically. But my guess is this is roughly who she was when she wrote that. This has been interpreted as modesty. It's not modesty. It's not modesty at all. She knew Lie never saw this. Lie does calculus of variations, and he never saw this. It was well known that the differential equations you get out of calculus of variations can normally be solved by using symmetries and conservations. This was just a standard mathematical fact, but nobody thought of it this way. Nobody before her saw it. Several people in Göttingen had already applied Lie's ideas to calculus of variations and conservation laws, getting Newtonian mechanics, getting special relativity, not getting Netter's theorems. Ooh, I don't normally say Netter's theorems, because I come from math. And in math, you say Netter's theorems, they say, well, And the ones they're least likely to think of are the conservation laws. It is true that most citations to her, last time I checked 300 citations in meth reviews, and they're nearly all to the conservation laws. But this is actually not because mathematicians don't think of her. The subject is called Noetherian rings. You don't have to cite Noether when you're doing Noetherian rings. Whereas if you go to cite Noether's theorem, you always say where it was. Also, you don't need to cite proof Noether's original proofs of the algebraic theorems, because they're in textbooks now. Those proofs are in textbooks now. Completely unlike these proofs. Also, formal calculus of variations just didn't exist before Noether. I've searched a lot on the references I could think of, searched a lot online. You search formale variationsrechnung, you will get some hits, but there's always a period in the middle. Something is formale. Meanwhile, variationsrechnung, it's not a phrase. It's the last of first words of the sentence. Formal calculus of variations didn't exist before. She says, oh, this is just formal calculus of variations. Well, let me tell you what that is, because it's not a thing that exists. And fortunately, working up to the standards of the time, what she doesn't do is tell us what it is. She does it, but she never tells us what it is.
Would Volterra be a candidate?
I haven't looked at that at all. Good thought. Here's where startling simplicity comes from. Nathan Jacobson, a student of Noether, when she visited to talk at the Institute in Princeton — the Institute doesn't like being said to be in Princeton, it's the Institute for Advanced Study, don't say Princeton, and here you probably shouldn't, because Princeton wasn't having her. The Institute was having her. And then he was her replacement in Vermont when she died. And then he becomes the editor of her collected works. Her proofs were and remain startling in their simplicity, and I think that's exactly true. That's the theme here. What I'm going to talk about, I want to talk about her life. I just don't know when that picture is. I'd like to know more about her life. But talk about her life in particular, something I really only thought of when I was preparing this. In 1913, she publishes a research program in Erlangen. We'll get to that. Versus her mature program for mathematics, what she's doing by the 20s, going into the 30s. Of course, she dies in the middle of the 30s. Why did she not pursue the conservation theorems? That's in the abstract that I gave. We'll come back to that quote. How she calculates variance and divergence. I myself was taking too much of it for granted. And that first equation I showed you, I thought, well, that's okay, anybody would write that. Well, no, not anybody would have written that. She writes it as if anybody would have. But we'll talk about how it's not true that just anybody would have. And what did formal mean to her in 1918? If she told us, I would quote what she says. She doesn't, but I'll talk about what's possible to know or guess about what it means to her. And of course that, I will mention, a little plug for philosophy of mathematics. We'd like to know better what formal means to different people. And I think if you want to, this was a good person to find out about what this one meant to her. She had a notable career in 19th century Erlangen. The long 19th century. I mean the one that ended in 1914. Especially in Erlangen. Actually, my first trip to Erlangen was in the 1990s, and my friend there wasn't sure that the 19th century had ended in the 1990s yet in her town. This is Erlangen 1905. I love pictures from 1905 because, of course, we've all read Einstein's papers, but we don't all think that that's how people were living when the papers were written. Maybe some of you do, of course. Some of you are more immersed in that, but I don't. By 1916, I'm not sure that picture was taken in 1916. The postcard was printed in 1916. But it's not obvious. But Erlangen was a very comfortable place, still kind of is. It was a distinctly old-fashioned place, not just at the university. The city was out there. Okay, dissertation published 1908, I believe, submitted 1907, and published 1908, this dissertation with Gordon. Published in Crowley's journal, well accepted work. This is a bitter fact, I think I can say bitter. Nobody today can read this dissertation. I've written to everyone I can think of who could plausibly be able to read this dissertation. There has recently been very nice new work on classical invariant theory, actually solving problems in higher and higher degree. I write to these people and they say, oh yeah, if you find someone who can read it, let me know. We'll talk more about her work in relation with Gordon. However, it got her elected to the Circolo Mathematico di Palermo. It got her elected to Deutsche Mathematische Vereinigung. I mean, the woman was internationally recognized long before she gets invited to Göttingen. She supervised a dissertation, not under her own name, of course, because she had no legal status at the university. But people knew. I mean, she's acknowledged in the dissertation. This was really reliable, old-fashioned, traditional mathematics, even by Erlangen's status, even by the standards of her advisor, Paul Gordon. She does a dissertation on things that Paul Gordon had been doing 30 years before. It's really not clear why she goes way back to 30 years before. The best guess would be what you might think, the only purpose of a dissertation is to finish it, right? It should not be your best work. But it's internationally recognized. Nothing that people today recall. And like I say, people today, you can't even read her dissertation. There's no definitions. Even the notation it's introduced, she uses a dozen Greek letters without telling you which one, what they're supposed to mean. They're related to Gordon. But no, it's very hard to read Gordon. As to her life in Erlangen, Hermann Weyl. We will have to talk a lot more about Hermann Weyl. In the eulogy, there was nothing rebellious in her nature. She was willing to accept conditions as they were. I think he got this from her little brother, Fritz. Here they are about to leave Germany. They were very close. I think it was likely true in Erlangen before 1915. I think at that part of her life, things were okay. The family was very comfortably off. She's being received into mathematical societies. She's supervising a dissertation. We just don't know what she thought about having an official title. It's just, she didn't write a lot. She talked a lot. She had very influential conversations. We'll get to some parts of math that she more or less revolutionized without writing a word of it herself. But I suspect that before 1915, things were okay. She was, we'll talk more, yeah. I do want to compare what her father, also a prominent mathematician, well, we say now also a prominent, in 1914, her father was a prominent mathematician and she wasn't yet. Her father, Max, was recruited to write the eulogy to Paul Gordon, her teacher, for the Mathematische Annalen, and they describe Gordon's teaching. He never did justice to developing concepts from the fundamentals. That was not his way. His lectures entirely avoided fundamental conceptual definitions, even such as limit. He doesn't define limits. His lectures rested on lively expression, the power gained from his own studies, rather than on logic and rigor. Yeah, there's a lot more to say about Paul Gordon. There's a lot more to say about all of this. And I want to mention, though, this was also the standard throughout calculus of variations. In Netter's paper in 1918, everything you can read around that time, everything I have read, everything I've looked at, the notations aren't standardized, definitions aren't given. It is lively, it's comprehensible, you can learn to do it from these books if you're good at that. But it's not, there are no definitions, there's no. And then I want to talk about her 1913 Erlanger program. A program is a new professor's declaration of research plans. Klein's Erlanger program is very famous. He describes geometry and he says, well, what we hear about it, he wants to describe geometries by giving the groups that they're invariant under. This is, in fact, one of about five things he talks about in his program. He's absolutely standard, new professor, will give a description of their research. What Klein did that wasn't as standard is he also tried to describe the next century of mathematics. He sort of thought, I'll get it started and everybody else will do this. And Netter, this paper of hers, Fields of Rational Functions, was effectively this. She lays out a program of research at just about the part of her life where, had she been male, she'd have been a newly hired professor somewhere. And she lays out this program of research, publishes it in the Jahresbericht, a very suitable place for publishing your program. You don't expect your program to get into Kreles or the Annalen. So whether she intended it or not, it really functions that way. It is to bring Gordon's perspective to the new algebra, the Dedekind, Weber, Hilbert algebra that she's learning from Gordon's successors when they come to give again. And she's going to bring Gordon's perspective to it. This is not what we hear about her, but I will say more about it. Anybody could have found this paper ambitious. She lays out a bunch of things she's going to do. Anybody looking at this would say, well, okay, you know, I mean, if you can, that's okay if you can do it. She fulfills it in a series of four papers taking 13 years. I would like to know more about, personally, why, you know, what was she working on when, but I'm afraid the records don't exist. And then she goes way beyond it. But the program itself is, it's not just incidental, it's not a dead end or something. It's by 1913. Okay, I can't document this. I don't have a quote of them saying this on paper. Well, I'll show you something like a quote of it on paper, but basically, by 1913, her father Max, her brother Fritz, and her teacher and colleague Ernst Fischer, these are people. They talk to each other in the morning. They go home and write postcards to each other that afternoon. I mean, they are jamming together. And they are all very aware that Emmy is on a level that they are not, and that few people ever are. I mean, they look at this 1913 paper. Okay, it hasn't all been done yet, but they know. They know. This is the one piece of written evidence we have. Here is the title to the eulogy to Paul Gordon, Max Netter. Mit Unterstützung von Felix Klein und Gürtelgener von Emmy Netter. I couldn't help it because you spoke some German with an accent and I like that. I like that so much. With support of Felix Klein and Gürtelgener and Emmy Netter and Erlanger. Not everybody gets named with Felix Klein in a line of the Mathematische Annalen. And he does sort of have to say later on, okay, from Klein helped me with the whole thing, and the second person helped me with the algebraic part. I mean, if there's a little lèse majeste in naming the two of them together in the pages of the Annalen. But yes, this is Dr. Anden. This is a new PhD who has not been given a license to teach, and she's being named with Felix Klein. He meant that. Well, the 20th century didn't stay away forever. The 20th century came to Erlangen. Erlangen, August 8th, 1914, 1 week after Germany declares war. Of course, it was no secret that war was coming. This is, if you can't quite make it out from the seats, this is infantry, Feldgrauen, the field grenades. This is the Feldgrauen. Marching through the town. Whether it still looked like that, whether it looked like that postcard again by 1916, I don't know. This is what it looked like that day in 1914. This had been a really bucolic place for people with money. Okay, now Germany had always been a hard place if you didn't, but and this is what it looks like. In 4 years, 2 million soldiers die. German soldiers die in the war. Let's just look at the German. We could ask others. But 2 million German soldiers die in the war. 500,000 German civilians die in famine. People like the Netters had not seen this coming. No, nobody really saw this coming. Well, historians could have. But then comes the German Revolution. And then, when you read histories of Germany in this period, the next period is called the Time of Troubles. Oh, first there was the war, then there was the revolution, then there was some trouble. Yeah. In Berlin, early March of 1919, 1,200 workers and soldiers are killed in protests. 1,600 are arrested. Now you compare those two numbers. There were nearly as many killed as arrested. They weren't bothering to arrest people. Why, they arrested some. Arrested more than half. The others they shot. Netter joins the Independent Social Democrats, the USPD. We know this. We have it on documents she wrote in her lifetime. And I think Cordula Tomey may have found her membership card in the archive at Göttingen. Anyway, she found more evidence than people already knew. We know this. She joined the Independent Social Democrats. By the 20s, she was well known to her colleagues as pro-Soviet. She visited Moscow several times, spent 6 months there one time. She was well known to be pro-Soviet. Weil, in his eulogy, says the USPD was close to the Social Democrats. So, honestly, this is like saying the Students for Democratic Society were close to the Democratic Party. And they were closer to the Democratic than the Republican, but, you know, the majority Social Democrats at this time, as you may know, they were paying to arm private militias. Blanking on the German name for the private militias now.
1935.
Yeah. No. The Freikorps. The earlier. The Freikorps. The SPD government is arming private militias called Freikorps, the free regiments. And anybody can set up a Freikorps who is in fact setting them up as nationalists who claim that the Jews defeated Germany in World War I. But not satisfied with that, the SPD passes a law. There is one category of people who cannot join a Freikorps, and that is members of the USPD. Right? It isn't just that they disagree with the USPD. This is the one body of people in Germany that is not allowed to be armed in a Freikorps. So, no, the USPD was not close to the Social Democrats. Not in any ordinary sense of that. Yeah.
But Hermann Weyl also is trying to appease Americans. Because they're not
helping
with Einstein or anybody. This is after 1933.
Yeah. There's lots more to say about that, and there's lots of nice evidence on that from other people also.
Sorry.
Yeah. I think to understand Netter, we'll get to Weil in a minute, but I think that particularly on the politics, this is not someone who only cared about mathematics. I like very much what a niece or great niece of hers said. We hear that all she cared about was mathematics. We don't know what she cared about. And I'm going to tell you, after having spent years on the problem, we seriously don't know what she cared about. We know what she did. We know what she did, but we don't know how she felt about what she was doing. But we do know that she joined she joined the independents, she traveled to Moscow, she was known as pro-Bolshevik among her friends. She did not join the Communist Party, which she could have done, but she was this. Weil says her period of relative dependence extended to 1919, that is, starting with dependence on Gordon, but that ended by 1913, then the transition from a Gordon's formal standard to the standpoint to the Hilbert method was accomplished. Weil is an indispensable source. You can't learn about Netter without reading Weil, and you must not try to learn about it. He's wrong about this, he's wrong about a lot of things. But never through lack of caring and never through plain ignorance. I've forgotten who told me this, but I've been told that some classroom in Cambridge, Weil came into it in tears and said, Emmy Netter has died. He was just shattered when he learned that she had died. He talks very movingly about what a wonderful person she was as he and others were being expelled from Germany. Okay, he personally didn't have to leave Germany, but his wife was Jewish. And I think Weil, he truly loved her. He sincerely supported her mathematics. He was way too good a mathematician to not know how important her mathematics was. But he tells us repeatedly, he also doesn't like that kind of math. He genuinely doesn't like that kind of math. He sees the value of her particular theorems, but he doesn't like that kind of math. It's also true, I would say, a wonderful thing about Weil, he will fault himself in his essays. He will tell you what he said wrong before. I don't mean he's infallible, he catches all his mistakes, but he will tell you, I said before this, and that wasn't really right. And I believe that he never, for a moment, thought, gee, women shouldn't be doing math, or how odd a woman doing math. But that doesn't mean he could relate to it. He sees this woman doing math, and it's like, okay, it's good stuff, but there's... So you have to read him, and you have to value him, but you have to know he's wrong about a number of things, especially about Emmy Netter. For 1913, she had her own method. She's combining Gordon with Hilbert, plus Dedekind and Lee. Those are the people she says are her sources. And she's doing it in ways that nobody before her had seen. She doesn't switch to the Hilbert method. And honestly, she doesn't even, you wouldn't know from her work that she even read much of Hilbert. Who she reads is Weber describing Dedekind. That's her source material on Hilbert's theorems. She's got her own method from 1913 on, and it is combining all of that. Now, here's something Weil gets exactly right. I wish I could have said it this well, and I can because I have a quote mark. I have a quote environment on my LaTeX. The ability to find the formulation which reveals the essential logical nature of the question, stripped of any incidental peculiarities which complicate matters and obscure the fundamental point. And this is beautifully put. Hermann Weil, who does not like algebraic thinking, does not like abstraction, he could have said, well, she finds these very concise abstract formulations, but that would not do them justice. No, he says, stripped of incidentals that complicate matters and obscure. I mean, he sees that that's really happening in her formulations. He does recognize that. But he tells us repeatedly that he also thinks that mathematics as a whole will suffer if we don't pull away from this abstracting method. If people keep this abstract stuff going on, well, he says the mathematicians of the coming generation will have a hard time. That prediction was never checked because they did have a hard time for completely other reasons. But the evidence is, no, Netter's approach did not run out. It has not run out. I think I'm not sure if Weil responded to Grothendieck at all. he did live to see some of Grothendieck's work, but whether he responded, I don't remember. Well, anyway, yes, he's wrong about Emmy Netter. The ardent foe of computation algorithms in mathematics. He says things like this several times. this is not just wrong about Emmy Noether, this is wrong about mathematics. I'm going to tell you that Hermann Weyl is wrong about math. Okay, I am, and you can take his side against me, but I'm just going to have to tell you, this is not how it works. Noether disparaged idle, wasted calculations. She hated, and she felt that her dissertation had been largely about. It's true. So did Gourdon. So does everyone who wants to actually calculate answers to questions. The whole art of extensive calculation is to find ways to skip as much of it as possible. That's how you get it done, always. The philosophic point, constructive mathematics that finds solutions in principle, has turned out to be surprisingly irrelevant to applied mathematics where they need solutions in fact. I have friends in applied math. Honestly, I don't read a lot of applied math, but I have friends who work in it. And I used to keep asking, do you read this constructivist? Do you read that constructivist? And say, no. No. Because in applied math, where you actually want solutions, the last step is always going to be calculable. And you don't care if the middle steps were calculable as long as they're correct. Kronecker, for example, really only cared about solutions in principle, and they stayed in principle until the 1950s for the most part. Most of Kronecker's theorems were completely unusable, in fact, because you couldn't get the calculations done until Noether's student and colleague Olgotowski Todd starts using computers on it. I don't know how exclusively it was her, but it was very much her. I just haven't. Gourdon, Noether, Dedekind wanted solutions. In fact, Gourdon welcomed Hilbert's basis theorem, which is plain historical fact. It's on paper. He did say, the proof isn't very clear, and the proof could be made more calculable. But he didn't look at it and say, well, that's not a calculation. He looked at it and said, that should help with calculation. He liked it. Noether was constructive when that helped and non-constructive when that helped, because she wanted to actually get answers. In 1915, she notes that she's outdone one of Hilbert's results by Gourdon's perspective. She says, this is the preface to what I consider her first really great mathematical article, 1915. The following is an entirely elementary finiteness proof for invariance of a finite group. Okay, not invariance of general linear groups. That was the Gourdon problem that Hilbert addressed in the 1880s. This is finite groups, which turned out to be a much more fruitful problem also. Which at once supplies an actual statement of a complete system of invariance, while the usual proof using the Hilbert basis theorem is only an existence proof. She puts this in the annals. I'm doing better than Hilbert about this. Weber's existence proof took 3 pages after Hilbert's theorem. She gives 2 proofs, 2 constructive proofs in a half a page each. And the method, oh, it's a lot to say about that. Reminiscent of Gourdon's method in several ways. Can't go into that right now. In 1926, in Hilbert's Gedichten, at the peak of her commutative algebra, she's got Gourdon's picture framed on the wall of her study. She has not abandoned Gourdon in favor of Hilbert. She supervises her first official doctoral dissertation, and I don't know how this escaped my attention for so long, but it escaped a lot of people. That is Greta Hermann. The question of finitely many steps in the theory of polynomial ideals. Hermann was the first to realize that if you want to effectively verify that you've got an effective routine, you have to estimate the number of steps. You need an upper bound on the number of steps it's going to take to complete this calculation. Nobody did that before. She goes through, okay, the number of steps, it'll be a function of the input size. For a ninth degree polynomial, you will need at most this many steps. It's complexity bounds. She does this for the routines for Noether's primary decompositions in the polynomial case. Noether enthusiastically promoted the work. We see this in the reports of the Gehenfall, Deutsche Mathematikvereinigung. It's still cited today, sometimes called the foundational paper of computer algebra. This is at the height of Noether's commutative algebra. She does not despise calculations and algorithms. She's fine with calculations and algorithms when they accompany the most efficient algebraic presentation of the subject. So now 2 related points, her mature program and why she abandoned her conservation theorems. And here's the quote that was in the abstract. With all the fervor of her nature, she was herself ready to forget what had been done in the first years of her mathematical activity, considering these results as standing apart from her true mathematical path, the creation of a general abstract algebra. Paul Alexandrov. Paul Alexandrov over there, famous for algebraic topology, creating the algebraic, the group theoretic version of algebraic topology with Hopf, Heinz Hopf, entirely based on Netter. He said, they say in the book, this goes entirely back to Emmy Netter. It looks obvious to us today. It was not so 8 years ago. It took all the energy and temperament of Emmy Netter.
Is Rita Herrmann the one who showed that von Neumann's theory about hidden variables?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. She gave the critique of the hidden variable, of von Neumann's invariable thing. I'll get back to her, but unfortunately, she just leaves mathematics. Anyway. This is Alexandrov and Yurison. There's some beautiful stuff to know about that also. But understand that this true path is not her specific theorems. No, her true path wasn't just to prove those theorems. Of course it was. Olga Towsky taught. A lot is known about her. I wish more was known about her. Not everyone trusted that her achievements were what they were later accepted to be. She irritated people by bragging about them. Later accepted to be. Towsky Todd is not questioning these achievements. But of course, some people at the time did. She was a student and then a colleague in Göttingen and again in Bryn Mawr. She follows her to Bryn Mawr. Everyone trusted Netter's theorems. The theorems were proved on paper. Nobody doubted the theorems. They doubted her vision of algebraizing all of mathematics. That's what Netter was bragging about. I suspect bragging is exactly the right term, although you could do a lot more to study all the tests you taught you. And it happened. It happened. Look, abstract algebra, beginning with von der Werden's Moderne Algebra, the whole elements of Bourbaki, they say that they based this partly on von der Werden, which they note is based on lectures by Netter and Artin having studied with Netter. Topology, beginning with Alexandrov and Hopf, later going into differential geometry, notably via fiber bundles, algebraic geometry, beginning with von der Werden. Later, Weyl, Sarah Grotendieck, they. You got these two people, etymologically the same name. they, Sarah Grotendieck, arithmetic, beginning with, and all of these unified in cohomology, beginning when her student Saunders MacLean did not understand factor sets. He tells us, I didn't understand factor sets. So he and Eilenberg invented category theory to explain what factor sets were. She didn't pursue her conservation theorems for long. She didn't pursue any of her theorems for long except the 1913 program. That she went back to repeatedly through the rest of her life. She had people do that. Herrmann began in computational algebra, but then left for math, for politics, and philosophy. This guy, Bessel Hagen, began in conservation theorems, then turned to history of math. And there's a lot more to know about him, too. Ah, now 60 years later, Peter Olver takes up the conservation theorem. This is the last of the Netter boys. There was a group called the Netter boys. This guy, he wasn't there for the walks in the country, but you read his book, he uses Netter's notation as much as a person possibly could. I mean, this guy is really steeped in her way of looking at it. He develops it by fiber bundle methods and cohomology, both descended from her commutative algebra. I guess I won't go into that. Well, okay, I think I'm running short on time, right? Okay, 5 minutes. I guess I want to get to the chief, what was her formal calculus of variations? I don't really know, and I would like to know. And if somebody else can tell me that, it'd be great. If I can figure it out for myself, that'll be great. But one thing was she skips solving differential equations. She calculates with formal linear combinations of the variations. She writes like this. She uses the Lagrangian expressions that we all know and love, but she writes them in linear combinations with these variations, because that's what she's going to, for one thing, because that's what she's going to need for the theorems, because that's what she finds is conserved, is linear, as divergences, as linear combinations. She doesn't cancel the variations and solve the Lagrangian equations. She calculates formally with the linear combinations of variations, just assuming that they're zero, assuming algebraically that they're zero. She's not solving any differential equations. The calculations are like the classical, except that she doesn't need the fundamental theorem of calculus of variations to cancel the variations, because she's not canceling them. This is a powerful idea to this day. It's not unique to Netter, but it is central to her heritage, and this is where what you see going on into the rest of her career. Calculations with formal linear combinations, it can help you find actual solutions. Maybe you calculate for a while formally before you find actual solutions. Or again, maybe you calculate formally because that's the best you can do. You're not going to get any solutions. You can't find solutions. Or again, maybe you don't want the solutions, but what you want can be gotten by calculating formally. And the point is that very commonly, that is what you want. That's what makes this important. For example, you might want to know that some family of ordinary differential equations always have stable equilibrium. But there's not a particular equation you're interested in, and you're certainly not trying to find its stable equilibrium, because there isn't one. So you're not trying to solve the equation. You want to know that everything in the family has such an equation. These kind of methods help with that. And this is half of cohomology. The other half, even more crucial, modding out, quotienting out suitable cases, maybe trivial cases. And this is what Olver comes back to with her calculus of variation. All over the place, cohomological theory is doing this. I said fiber bundles, which physicists might know as, connections on fiber bundles, physicists might know as gauge theories. Complex analysis, which physicists will know is used in conformal field theories. The variational complex. And Olver uses this to clarify Netter's theorems 1 and 2. And I'm going to agree with Olver that the theorem on symmetries is really theorem 1. Theorem 2 is a theorem on when they're trivial. It's not about when they exist, it's about when they're trivial. It's a somewhat different division than Netter made in the first place. Netter ignores some somehow trivial symmetries. She says, in this case, we'll throw those ones out because they're trivial. When she says, there will be rho many linearly independent combinations, that's unless some of them are zero. She said, if some of them are zero, don't count those ones. It's the initial work. Olver formulates that precisely by defining triviality and modding it out. I want to end with this picture of Emmy Netter. This is a mathematician who, I will tell you, based on long thought, she had the ardent support of her family from the moment she was born. Her parents knew that all their children would get doctorates. Kobolevskaya had gotten a doctorate 4 years before Emmy was born. They knew it was possible. They knew it would not be easy. When their first child was a daughter, they didn't change their plans. All their children were going to get PhDs. She had ardent support from the most influential mathematicians of the time. She wanted to change the whole practice of mathematics, and she did. She did, but she did not ever draw a salary or have a permanent job. She was not modest, and she was not wrong when she wrote to Helmut Hasse, saying, my methods are working in conceptual methods, and so they penetrate everywhere anonymously. Of course, a lot less anonymous in the last 30 years than they were for most of the years in between. Okay, thanks.
Nobody knows. It is four volumes of collected works. They're Yomiku in Spanish.
Oh, I know.
Yeah, and they're on anthropology.
Yeah.
And he published them in the Mexican Math Journal. And when I pointed this out to Ben Ekman, he didn't want anybody to read them.
Right. You published a note about that, didn't you?
In the box. Well,
okay, I saw a note about that.
Okay. Ben Ekman said, it's like he didn't want people to read this paper. And Benno said, yes, topology has never been respectable. And he said Hilbert thought all of Poincaré's stuff was junk, deuxième, troisième complément, every 80-page paper is half wrong. And what Poincaré was doing was not mathematics, according to Hilbert. And what Hermann Weyl was doing there was taking stock
of what was algebraic in algebraic topology. He starts off with Kirchhoff's laws, and it's the first place where you see the signature of a Foreman.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of amazing. And then the key thing is, when Hermann Weyl left ETH in 1930 to succeed Hilbert in Göttingen, he got this young punk to be the head of the department. Everybody was kind of scandalized, but Heinz Hoff was straight almost out of his PhD, and it was Hermann Weyl did the most amazing things for topology and MLR tuning. So that's one comment, how topology came out of the closet, algebraically. The other one is, what he said is distinctive about her style. There's two mathematicians that come to mind. People come out of engineering to math. Henry McKean's one, capability, teacher. But Raoul Bonnet is the one I pointed to, because he started off life in engineering. As an engineer, having two Fields Medalists as students, that close to each male. He embodies this kind of stuff. So if you look at cohomology, Ellenberg's theory on formulation of algebraic topology and all this, you can vary the coefficient group in the axioms. There's sort of standard type of cohomology theories. Then you have extraordinary ones, first one being cobordism theory, second one being K-theory. And Voss started K-theory by computing the stable homotopy groups of Lie groups. Topologists hated this because he did it by computing geodesics on Lie groups. And all these topologists are looking at, why is this kid computing using calculus of variations? We're doing topology. There's a final paper he wrote before he died a few months on the 75th anniversary of this paper, where he said everything he did would be trivial had Hermann Weyl talked to Marston Morse. Basically, put together the two, and it was just calculus. And Bott has this happy warrior way of prancing around algebraic topology, just doing calculus. And he's copying calculations, but it's kind of wild.
So I'm trying to reconcile what you said with the previous talk. You said that there are two theories came out of variational calculus and the.
Well, she said.
That's what you said.
Well, it's a quote.
So the question is, how does that reconcile with this notion of classical symmetry, right? Was the first theory. And then the second theory was this sort of infinite dimension.
Well, I think there I'm going to go back to what I said about Peter Olbermann, because even when she gives the two theorems, she says the existence of the symmetries really is already in the first theorem. It's just a question of how many of them there are. And when there's a lot of them parameterized by an infinite Lie group, then there's going to be these dependencies. And Catherine you're exactly right about how that problem got there. And if Hilbert had already expected there should be, knew there were dependencies in some cases.
So are you saying that covariance is basically an infinite
relation? Yeah. Well, that's what I think it's fair to. What do you think? It's fair to say that Nenner sort of clarifies Hilbert on that. But that Hilbert already sort of means it should be, if it's invariant out of the general group, then it's.
Yeah, she does what she does. She says, look, general covariance, the way you're thinking about it, is an example.
And that's, Hilbert already thought, gee, this must be Lie group theory. Hilbert uses Lie group theory in his invariant theory in 1890, but he didn't follow through and make it Lie group theory, and Netter does. Netter says it's just Lie group theory, just write it on the page, it's Lie group theory. But Hilbert already thought it sort of was Lie group theory. Of course, infinite dimensional Lie groups are not usually precisely defined to this day, because you need topological vector spaces. People have done it, but you read the calculus, the books at the time, it's really a little bit hard to define what you mean. Lie himself is embarrassed. These infinite dimensional groups don't work quite like.
Well, finite dimensional ones are analytic.
Yeah.
And you don't have the analyticity in infinite dimensions, so you don't know it.
You just don't know what it would even mean.
So I'm reading there about her papers and the papers around the time on her parents, and I had the impression that the work she did on the 1918 paper was kind of inside, you know, they'd asked her herself, and so she did. So there you go, and then got back to what she was really interested in. But the way you've given the talk makes it sound like what she didn't put to experience was much more kind of part of this general thing that she did anyway in her overall project, and that is really interesting to me.
I don't think she was aware of that connection when she did it, but the connection is there. Of course, she had done other work on differential invariants. I think the unity she saw, on the one hand, you're exactly right. They said, why don't you do this problem? She said, of course I can do that problem. I believe that by 1913, she had an idea of her own power. She had been a good mathematician. She was in those societies, but she'd come to think, no, I'm really good. And when they come to her with a problem related to her methods, she's not a problem to that. And then she looks at it and she says, it's just a Lie group theory. And I think she expected to find that it was just something like that. So there's this inchoate, incipient idea that she has a radically simplifying method that's just going to clarify everything. And I think she saw that as an exercise in that simplification already. But I don't know that she saw it concretely. And I don't think she'd have said, oh, look, the cool thing is I'm using linear combinations. But she does take care to use linear combinations, which not everybody did.
Just a small comment, open to legitimate symmetry, is a question of relevance. In Jean Bigner's article on symmetries in the 60s, the comments about it in the literature, it's a great irony, the most famous paper on symmetry never uses the word.
Yeah. And I mean, von der Waarden was clear, these methods are going to rewrite algebraic geometry, and they go on to, those methods go right through Grothendieck. But she doesn't think of it geometrically. I think it's Jacobson who actually says her methods allowed us to geometrize many problems, but not because she thought of them geometrically. It's her methods, you know, not her way of thinking. I want to say he works so directly from her ideas.
Yeah.
It's not just that he's influenced by her. He pulls on her ideas.
And then the other thing is Bessel Hagen. Can you tell me a little bit more
about
the connection between them? So Bessel Hagen proves a connection between the conservation of charge before she does her 19.
Yeah. Yeah, and then he has this paper where he says we can have divergent symmetries. We don't need it to be an actual symmetry. And he says, I got this idea from Fraulein Netter. And he did. He's working with her on this.
So he's in Gershwin
too. Yeah. He's working with her. And this is the pattern that you see in von der Waarden, in Alexandrov, in the others who work with her. Bessel Hagen had a congenital illness, and so he was the victim of many practical jokes. I'm quoting Wikipedia here. Carl Ludwig Siegel, this is a practical joke we play on Bessel Hagen. Carl Ludwig Siegel got the only copy of Bessel Hagen's dissertation. They were friends, Bessel Hagen using the dissertation to read. For months he doesn't read it. Finally he's on this ocean cruise, and he starts to look at it, and he throws it overboard. And he goes back to Bessel Hagen and says, I've done you a favor, I threw it away. I can promise you that several sites and sources online describe this as a practical joke. But due to such practical jokes, Bessel Hagen quit mathematics and went into math education. Yeah, he was weird, so people did stuff to him.
What was the relationship of her to Carl?
I doubt there was any relationship. I will tell you, I asked Jean Percet, so when you were learning group cohomology in 1948, did you learn anything about Netter's contributions to it? And he said, Netter, I don't know why you'd ask about her. Richard Brouwer did all the important work. So I think there was a certain lack of historical insight, yeah, a certain lack of historical connection between Kierkegaard and Paris.
Because I heard a lecture
about
Chern, and it was a great and he said that Einstein ruined differential geometry. and that there was this correspondence between Planck and Einstein. And, you know, if one had to do with coordinates, the other one had to do with coordinates. So the point was that the differential geometries thought that Einstein had ruled differential geometry that resolved polarization versus differential. Have you run into that at all?
No, Noether never uses geometric terminology, and Noether is my really only access to this kind of topic.
So Einstein was quite pedestrian on the mathematics. Turing, I think, is a student of Washke, and Hermann, he returned to China, and Hermann Weyl pulled him back to Princeton because he was just about a young person on the literature. And it was Hermann Weyl who really struggled to get Einstein to talk to Tarkan. There is a book of John Satchel called Lena. So Hermann Weyl is still the central figure in Turing, Einstein,
But Noether just doesn't go into geometry, right. Just not a relation.
Well, let's thank
So, when did the term formal power series start? So I was